A shakeup for next week's presidential debate in Miami. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The second presidential debate was scheduled for next week. The candidates are being required to join remotely, but the president is threatening not to show up. NPR's Greg Allen will talk about that and the ongoing battle between Florida's governor and municipal leaders. Plus, we're going to look at the history of racism in Latin America and why some Latinos in Miami are against the Black Lives Matter movement. Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett will give us some historical context. Finally,
the first season was really probably the most fun short of those championship years.
The Miami Heat are in the NBA Finals. How are players staying healthy while living in a bubble? We spoke with the team's longtime doctor. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks for your support during this fall membership campaign. Next week's scheduled presidential debate in Miami has been thrown into limbo. The Commission on Presidential Debates announced this morning that the candidates needed to join the debate remotely as President Trump continues to recover from the coronavirus from the White House. During an interview on Fox News this morning, President Trump said he will not participate in the debate if it's virtual, calling the format, quote, a waste of time. A statement from Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden's campaign said they will not participate in the October 15th debate and instead will take questions directly from voters in a separate event. They are calling for the Commission on Presidential Debates to move it a week later to October 22nd. Greg Allen is NPR's national correspondent in Miami, and he explained why the commission wanted the debate virtual in the first place.
Well, I think after that last debate, which was roundly criticized as a total failure, maybe the worst presidential debate in history, the commission was somewhat chagrined, and they put out a statement fairly quickly after the debate saying that there were going to have to be changes come forward. And we were waiting to see what those changes would be. They said this morning that the changes would be that the two candidates would be in a remote location, but the audience and the moderator would be in a single place. I mean, that seemed to be aimed at making sure that no one contracted the coronavirus more than anything else.
We will continue to keep you updated on the status of the debate on All Things Considered and online at WLRN.org. We also spoke with Greg about his recent story for NPR about Florida moving into phase three of reopening as we continue to battle the coronavirus pandemic. Governor Ron DeSantis moved Florida recently into phase three of reopening, basically reopening everything. What, though, do local governments have when it comes to power, when it comes to penalizing businesses or people for not doing things like social distancing or wearing masks, compared to what, I mean, the governor said, basically, no penalties, let's get back to business.
Right. And when he came down with that pronouncement, I think the thing that really bothered local governments as much as anything was the fact that many of them didn't see it coming. I think Mayor Jimenez here in Miami-Dade County said that he had some advance word from staff that was coming down, but they really didn't know the details. And then when it came down on a Friday afternoon, it was not very specific in a lot of ways. Some of the comments were made by the governor at a news conference, and then later in the day we saw the executive order, and it wasn't even specific enough in many cases. So the local governments, counties and cities, didn't really know what to think. And then you had the weekend came, and in a lot of places around the state, including Miami and in Broward County and elsewhere around the state, the bars filled up with people not wearing masks, and we saw the videos, and that was of some concern, and it was not clear to the local governments what their authority was at that point. There was some clarification done as the week went on, and the biggest concern, of course, comes around face masks. But there are still provisions that the local governments can impose on businesses, and many, if not most, local governments have some local restrictions still in place for businesses on occupancy and on requiring social distancing and requiring face masks in many cases. So that it's still being kind of worked out case by case. But at least at this point, I think the local governments feel that they have the authority and the acquiescence of the governor to go ahead with these restrictions.
So last week we spoke with Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, who's also running for Congress, about what he would do if the county saw another surge in cases. Here's what he said.
My term ends on November 17th. If I start to see a a positivity rate and then an increment again, I'll have to call the governor and say we need to take additional steps here. Hopefully we won't get to that, but if we do get to that, you know, I'll be calling him, and I'm sure that he will take the appropriate measures to make sure that we can combat any kind of increase in the best ability.
So a second ago you said, Greg, that, you know, the local governments still may have some power, but I don't know, does it seem like local leaders essentially are at the whim of the governor in this case?
Well, you know, there is an emergency order in place, and with emergency powers, the governor has a lot of say here. You know, he can basically make these pronouncements, and local governments have to comply. But on the other hand, the home rule charter in Miami-Dade County is part of the Florida Constitution. So, you know, these are things that Mayor Jimenez brought up. There are conflicting powers here, conflicting claims, but I don't think anyone wants to go to court and kind of assert these. And I don't think that they think it'll come to that. As you say, you know, both the governor and Mayor Jimenez are Republicans. They kind of see eye to eye on a lot of issues. But it would be really interesting if the mayor here in Miami-Dade County felt he wanted to impose more restrictions again, because the governor has said, you know, we're not going back, and he's full speed ahead. You know, we've seen what he said about the Dolphins, the Miami Dolphins, that they can play to a full stadium. He said that as part of his this order that he put down at the end of September. Of course, the Dolphins are not ready to go that route yet, as far as we know. Most of the NFL teams are taking a much more prudent course than what Governor DeSantis is advocating, but that's kind of left up to the teams. And if a local government wanted to be more restrictive, they would have to make the case to the governor and get him to go along with it. And I'm not sure at this point what would happen if that's required here in Miami-Dade County.
And we're seeing leaders across the state taking very different approaches. How does, like, for example, St. Petersburg differ from what you're seeing in Miami?
Well, I think there, you know, St. Petersburg's another place where there's a lot of activity right after that that order came down from the governor. You know, talked to Mayor Kreisman there, and he said that, you know, they so far are finding that businesses are actually restricting their occupancies voluntarily. And we're seeing this a lot around the states. Businesses, even though they're told they can go to 100% occupancy inside, they're kind of loath to do so because they've seen what happened in the past when they've tried to do that, and you've had outbreaks among their staff and customers, and it doesn't do anybody any good.
And so, you have that, but also how about liability issues? Could that become problematic for businesses?
It's interesting because that was brought up by Mayor Jerry Demings, the county mayor in Orange County in the Orlando area, and he was very unhappy with this order, at least the way he acted at his news conferences after it came down, and partly because they were taken by surprise. And in that county, they've been much more open than Miami-Dade in terms of promoting, you know, businesses to come back and reopen. Of course, the theme parks are there. So he's been very open that way. But this took him by surprise. And he gave kind of a stark warning to businesses saying, you know, I'm just telling you, before you do anything, you look at your liability, your insurance policies, because there could be liability issues here if you have customers and staff who contract COVID-19 as a result of your policies. So that's why I think a lot of businesses around the state are being much more prudent than even what the governor is advocating at this point.
And of course, we look at schools. So, you know, the last of the schools here in South Florida are reopening. Miami reopened this week. Broward County will be reopening this week as well. You said the governor is looking back, but if things got really bad, is there a circumstance where they could say, well, at least with the schools, we have to go back?
You know, I would think that the health and safety of you know, the kids in school is going to be paramount, I think, for everybody here. The one thing that's somewhat concerning is the governor talks repeatedly about how children are not at risk. And this is a line that we've heard from President Trump and the White House, saying that, you know, kids, they say repeatedly things that medical experts don't agree with. They say, well, you know, kids don't get it as much and they're not at risk and they don't transmit it. Well, there is some evidence along these lines, but no one, not to the case where you're going to have a public health expert is going to say, yes, we can have kids back in school and then over risk of getting it or spreading it. You know, it's just not clear at this point. So there's a lot more certainty. So the political leaders have a lot more certainty than the medical experts on these issues. I would think if, in fact, what we're starting to see is in some parts of the state, the numbers have started to tick up slightly. And whether that's because of the openings or whether it's because of schools starting again, it's hard to know. And it's not it's not a trend yet, but we Mayor Gelber in Miami Beach brought that up just yesterday in a message to his constituents, saying we're starting to see this tick up again. And he showed a chart comparing it to July, when the numbers started to tick up after, I'm sorry, in June, after the Memorial Day holiday, which led to a lot of gatherings. And we saw the surge after that had been peaked in July. Mayor Gelber was pointing out the similarity to what we're seeing then and now in terms of the very beginning of this surge. So we hope that's not going to happen, and we're not going to test all these things. But, you know, the governor recently said that he thought that closing the schools in March, in hindsight, was a mistake. He called it one of the biggest public health mistakes in American history. Or modern American history, I think he said. So, you know where the governor is on this, but whether local officials are and where medical experts are is a whole different place.
And we will see what happens in the next couple of weeks after all the reopenings. Greg, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Lewis.
That was Greg Allen, NPR's national correspondent in Miami. You can follow his stories on our website, WLRN.org. Still to come, why are some Latinos in South Florida against the Black Lives Matter movement? That's coming up next. But remember, shows like this are made possible by people like you. With your support, this is our fall membership campaign, and we need your support. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for your support for shows like this. All polling data suggests that it will be an incredibly close presidential race here in Florida, with the Latino vote being one of the deciding factors for the victor. One of the key issues that's continually come up for Latino voters has been the Black Lives Matter movement. Throughout a number of Latin American publications and radio shows, some conservative Latinos have expressed contempt for the movement and spread false information. In this week's Latin America Report, correspondent Tim Padgett explored the history of racial justice movements in Latin America and how that may be influencing how the movement is discussed among Latinos in South Florida. We spoke with Tim earlier today. Tim, how has the Black Lives Matter movement been discussed in much of Latin American media in South Florida?
Well, it depends on if that media is pro-Trump or not. If it is pro-Trump, the discourse regarding Black Lives Matter has been demonizing at best and racist at worst in a lot of cases. As we reported this week, there's one outlet called Actualidad Radio here in Miami, a Spanish language radio station that has been making particularly racist remarks about Black Lives Matter, accusing it of witchcraft and devil worship and wanting to burn down cities and kill police officers. And it's just rhetoric that has really been elevated this past summer about Black Lives Matter as a way of supporting President Trump vis-a-vis connecting Black Lives Matter with Joe Biden and the Democrats.
And why is Black Lives Matter often linked to communism and the extreme left?
Well, because in its earlier iteration, before a lot of these mass protests that we've been seeing in the streets in the past few years emerged, there were a couple of co-founders of Black Lives Matter who did have some Marxist leanings. But the big evidence that a lot of anti-Black Lives Matter, particularly Latinos, point to as, quote, evidence that Black Lives Matter is Marxist is that one of the co-founders had her picture taken with Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in New York a few years ago. That's pretty thin evidence for labeling an entire movement Marxist. And most, if not all, political analysts, especially here, will tell you that Black Lives Matter is not a Marxist organization. It is a racial justice movement that has been demonstrating in force. It is not a movement that's out to turn the United States into a socialist Marxist state like Cuba or Venezuela, as so many conservative Latinos here have been accusing it of this summer.
We talk about the issue of racism. Help us understand the similarities and the differences in the experience of Black communities in the U.S. and the Black experience in Latin America.
Well, both experiences are a struggle. Let's just say that up front. I mean, both Black Americans in the U.S. and Afro-Latinos in Latin America both face pretty stark racism, systemic racism. The one difference I think you could point to, according to experts, is that in Latin America, that racism is much more hidden than it is in the United States. There's not the sort of talk about it. There's not the sort of activism about it in Latin America that you find in the United States. In Brazil, for example, if you suggest to any white Brazilian that Brazil might have systemic racism, they'll look at you flabbergasted and say, "But no, we gave the world Pele, right? You know, the soccer superstar who is black." So it's much more hidden in Latin America. There's much more denial about racism in Latin America compared to the United States, although obviously we do have a lot of denial amongst white people in the United States about racism. But I think that's one of the key differences that experts point out is just much more hidden in Latin America.
And how do you see, the different countries? Well, I mean, like the United States compared to Latin American countries, how they confront racism? How do we do it here compared to elsewhere?
Well, here, as I pointed out, there's much more activism, particularly vis-a-vis movements like Black Lives Matter, the civil rights movement back in the 1960s. In Latin America, you've never really seen something like a civil rights movement for black people in Latin America, even in left-wing countries that are governed by left-wing regimes. In Cuba, you've never really seen any sort of overt active movement to gain more civil and human rights for black people. As I said, be it a large country like Brazil or small countries in Central America, it's just something that we've never really seen the way we've seen it in the United States.
You know, some Venezuelans see parallels with the Black Lives Matter movement and the Bolivarian Revolution that brought Venezuela to where it is today. What parallels do you see?
Yeah, here's where the whole racial dynamic with Latinos, particularly white Latinos, conservative white Latinos here, and especially those who support Trump, this is where the racial, if not racist, dynamic gets really baroque, really convoluted. But some experts make the very good point that if you go back to a country like Venezuela and you see a left-wing regime like the Bolivarian Revolution that Hugo Chavez started in Venezuela, a lot of Venezuelan expats here, they think back to that revolution in Venezuela, that socialist, disastrous socialist revolution that led them to flee here to the United States. And one of the things they remember is that it was supported to a great extent by black or darker-skinned Venezuelans living in very poor barrios in places like Caracas. They remember seeing black people in Venezuela come out in force in favor of that revolution. So when they come here to the United States, to a place like South Florida, and they see Black Lives Matter, black activism in the streets, subconsciously or not, they associate that black activism in the United States with the left-wing revolution that they fled in Latin America. And that causes them, again, whether it's conscious or not, but it does cause many of them then to have a very negative reaction toward a movement like Black Lives Matter, which unfortunately all too often manifests itself in outright racism.
So, Tim, you spoke with a Danielle Cleland. She's a Black Latina, and she teaches Latino studies at the University of Texas. She taught here at FIU for a decade.
Miami has been the place where I've been made most aware of being Black by Latinos. Racism is hidden in Latin America to maintain the status quo. And so when you come here and you see, particularly now, black activism in the streets, people cannot hide from it anymore. And so when you are confronted with this, it creates a negative and racist reaction.
So this complicated relationship with race for some Latinos, is that heightened in Miami?
I would think so, because this is such a particularly Latino community, but also a community that has a very rich and deep tradition of a black community. I mean, let's face it, Miami in large part was founded by black Bahamians. So you've got those very strong, those two very strong communities rooted here. And there's not a lot of mutual understanding, unfortunately, between the two. And I think you probably do have more of a tense dynamic here than in perhaps other places in the country. Although I remember when I was just, you know, starting out as a journalist in Chicago in the 1980s, the tensions between blacks and Hispanics, blacks and Latinos, was also very sharp. This is not confined to Florida by any means, and it's not confined to just, you know, Cubans and blacks or Venezuelans and blacks.
And what has Cleland said about the inclusion of Afro-Latinos in the Black Lives Matter movement?
Well, I think there has been an effort to get Afro-Latinos more involved, particularly Caribbean, Black Caribbean citizens here, to get them more involved, to make them feel included, because I think there is a recognition in movements like Black Lives Matter that Black Latinos often feel left out of the Latino experience here in the United States. Just referring back to the professor that we just heard from, Danielle Cleland, one of the points she made to me that when she was living here, she lived here for about a decade in Miami as a professor at FIU, and one of the things that she always noticed was that she's a Black Puerto Rican, and whenever she tried to speak Spanish with white Latinos here, they wouldn't speak Spanish with her, she said, because they didn't consider her one of them as a Latino, right? So I think the Black Lives Matter movement is increasingly realizing that Black Latinas like her do want more involvement, more acceptance in Black activism here in the United States.
And when you talk about the Black Lives Matter movement within the Latino community, is there a generational divide? Do we see differences?
The hostility and the often racist hostility that you do see among some Latinos toward Black people and Black Lives Matter is often, you know, among the older generation. Again, the Latinos who have a history back in Latin America itself and have those complicated, you know, relationships with race that they bring here to communities like Miami. Younger Latinos don't always carry that racial or, unfortunately, racist baggage with them, and it's not as prevalent, you know, in their generation.
You just heard from WLRN's Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett. You can follow his stories on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, the Miami Heat are fighting to stay alive in the NBA Finals, down 3-1 to the Lakers. But we spoke with the team doctor about staying healthy in the NBA bubble. Once again, we want to thank you for your support for programs like this. But if you haven't pledged your support in this fall membership campaign, well, what are you waiting for? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for your support during this fall membership campaign. Well, the Miami Heat will take to the court Friday night in Orlando for Game 5 of the NBA Finals. The Los Angeles Lakers hold a 3-1 lead. They can win it all on Friday night. The game, like all others these last few months, are being held in a bubble. The NBA decided that the best way to protect players was to keep them all in one city and put restrictions on who can go in and out of that bubble. Earlier this summer, we spoke with Dr. Harlan Selznick, the team's doctor. We spoke about the bubble, spending a career as a team doctor, and remembering some great Miami Heat memories.
Before they went into the bubble, every one of the players was tested essentially every day for COVID to make certain that nobody was going to be COVID positive when they arrived in Orlando. And if someone did test as COVID positive, they would be kept out of the bubble until they subsequently would have 2 negative tests, be asymptomatic for a number of days, and also have cardiology screening, because COVID has been shown to have some cardiac effects in some patients, and the players have to go through evaluation by a cardiologist, get an EKG and an echocardiogram. Whenever they're interacting with anyone else, they would have to wear masks, maintain social distancing, hand washing, and then they were allowed to begin practicing with those parameters, as well as limiting exposure to players on other teams.
As the team doctor, I mean, you're used to spending a lot of time with the players, but how does it work, you know, with Inter Miami and with the Miami Heat? How much time are you going to just spend in Orlando with the teams?
Well, Inter-Miami, I actually went up for the first game. But to do that, I was tested 72 hours in advance, 24 hours in advance here in Miami, drove straight up to Orlando, was tested there and quarantined till the test came back negative, and then was allowed to cover the game as the venue medical director. And then I came back. As far as the NBA goes, they have a much longer quarantine period and different rules. And what the league has done is they've found NBA doctors that had the ability to take some time off, some former NBA doctors, some regional doctors, and anyone that is willing to cover all the teams and commit to at least a month at a time is allowed in the bubble as a physician. So I'm not going to be able to have a whole lot of interaction being at the games, which is something we're not used to, you know, particularly when it comes to the playoffs. It tends to be important to have your own team physician there to make sure that it's safe for your player to play, someone's not pulled out that could play, that someone that has a laceration doesn't take too long to have it sutured or whatever. So that can affect the outcome of games. So there are concerns with that.
Let me switch things up. I want to ask you about, I read some of your Jock Doc articles in the Miami Herald, and I found one from a couple of years ago. A student asked you, what does it take to get into sports medicine? And I guess, you know, briefly, I mean, how do you describe what it takes to specialize in sports medicine?
Yeah, well, there's two avenues, really, where someone can get into sports medicine. Obviously, you have to go through medical school. And when you're in medical school, you're kind of exposed to numerous options, cardiology, dermatology, obstetrics, orthopedics, whatever. And if you have a real interest in sports medicine, you're usually looking at going one of two pathways, either doing a residency in orthopedic surgery, like I did, or doing a residency in primary care, family practice medicine.
Why did you get into it?
Well, when I started out, sports medicine really didn't exist. I had actually read an article in the New York Times about one of the first sports medicine doctors in this new field that was being created. I always loved sports. I liked orthopedic surgery. And it just seemed like a great combination for me. When I went to medical school, I didn't know what I'd do. My father was an obstetrician. I decided after going through medical school, that was not what I wanted to do. And sports medicine just was an exciting new avenue, and I've been lucky to be able to do it.
Did you grow up watching sports, or did you play?
The answer is I grew up watching sports. I played a number of sports, tennis and basketball and things in high school. But, you know, there's not a lot of opportunity for short, slow Jewish point guards. And so I felt that I had a better shot at longevity of doing it as a doctor.
Thank you for that. You know, when talking about basketball, I mean, you've been with the Miami Heat since the beginning of the team. How did you end up with them?
I've been very fortunate. The average team physician's in the league about 4 years. And as I said, this is my 32nd year. When I was in medical school, I had the opportunity to be the assistant team physician for the Chicago Bulls when I was at Northwestern for several years. And also the NBA used to have, and still does, has a combine where college players will play for a number of days before the team scouts. And, so I met a number of people involved. When I came to Miami, there really weren't many sports doctors, and I think every orthopedic surgeon in town applied. And I interviewed, and even though I was young, they were nice enough to give me an opportunity to show that I could do the job, and so far I'm still doing it.
So the team started in 1988. What's your fondest memory of that first season?
The first season, obviously the championship years were a lot of fun. But the first season was really probably the most fun short of those championship years. Everything was new. We had an opportunity to set up the sports medicine and the training and everything, you know, that we considered state of the art at the time. All the players were new or excited to be there. Ron Rothstein was the coach, who was very colorful in his youth, and it was just an incredible amount of fun. So I would say just that whole first season, I can't think of one specific memory, was just an incredible amount of fun.
That was Dr. Harlan Selznick, the Miami Heat's longtime team doctor. He also works as the team physician for the Miami Major League Soccer team, Inter Miami. You can hear the full interview at WLRN.org/sundial. And that's our program for this Thursday, October 8th. Sundial senior producer is Chris Remington. Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zapka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. The theme music for this program is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo at gobalo.com. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe, be good to each other, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again live on Monday.